So welcome back to the Coaches and Leaders Assemble podcast with me, Laura Royal, your host, and of course, my business DNA coach, all things coaching, leadership, people and culture. And I'm absolutely buzzing today because I get to have our lovely guest interviewee, the wonderful Charlotte Angus. I refer to you as my OG mentor, my original person that I wanted to be like when I grew up. And I've known you for a very long time, and it's a real pleasure to have you on today. So welcome, Charlotte. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Yes, it has been a long time. And it makes me laugh when you say that because I'm just like, oh, I don't feel grown up enough to be anybody's person that they grow into.
Well, actually, me neither, if I think about it. But of course, we've known each other a very long time. Our early days working in contact centres, so one-to-one back in the day, then T-Mobile. And you were our fantastic learning consultant, and I learned loads from you in my very early career as a trainer. And I followed you. I even followed you down to the dizzy heights of Sunderland at one point, didn't I, when I lived there for a short time? The least said about that, the better.
It's so exciting to me to turn up to events. I was just like, hello.
Hello, what are you doing here? Was it the Oak Tree Farm in Sunderland? I came to one of them. There we go. Because I lived just around the corner. So you never thought I'd be following you to your geographical location.
I love it though. Thanks.
I know, me too. So I've got, of course, your lovely overview of what you're up to these days. So Charlotte is a leadership development specialist, business psychologist, I'm loving this, executive coach, of course, as many of your hats, and of course, a person with a passion for understanding how the brain shapes leadership, communication, well-being, and performance. And I love this about you, Charlotte, you're making psychology accessible. And I think today, certainly on your chosen subject of choice, it sounds like we're going to burst into that. What's that TV show where it's your subject of choice? Is it Mastermind?
Mastermind, yeah.
I feel it's a bit like that today. But of course, you're going to share lovely thoughts on imposter phenomenon today, which I'm excited about. And you also told me you're doing lots of great work right now. So things that are grounded in business psychology and behavioural science, and you're really working with individuals and organisations to unlock potential, enhance effectiveness and build cultures of high performance, innovation and sustainable success. And you also said as well, and I could mention your Zoom jazz hands.
Oh yes, my greatest skill. I love a bit of that. Honestly, it's like the pandemic. This is my pandemic gift was I never thought that I'd be happy online, but I was just like, oh, I love it. I love it. I love welcoming people into the virtual room and getting speakers set up and doing things. So, yeah, all of the volunteering I did for the CIPD and the Association for Coaching is just me living my best life.
I love it, indeed. And then, of course, you've caught my attention as always, but more recently because you've been diving into the world of imposter phenomenon in particular. So before we dive into that, is there anything else you want to tell us about your fabulous self before I kind of quiz you with a couple of questions and see where the conversation takes us?
I think the thing that I'm probably most passionate about is that we spend most of our waking hours at work.
Yes.
And sometimes that's really, really tough. And most people are doing the best that they can with the resources that they've got. So if I can help people find ease and flow so that work is easier, lighter, so that when they leave work, whatever's outside of work is more enjoyable, you're not carrying kind of the weight of whatever, then that's kind of my goal in life, because we all deserve more and the world is particularly heavy right now. So anything that helps work and then helps life outside of work, I'm all about.
Yeah, definitely. And we had a brief conversation just before we started, didn't we, around intentional living. So I think some of that transcends into that conversation as well. So Charlotte, imposter phenomenon. So the reason I thought, oh gosh, this will be great to explore on the podcast is I recognise in myself from time to time, I have sort of fleeting moments where that imposter shows up. And it usually shows up in things like my thoughts, that negative self-talk where I might be saying things like, you know, gosh, I can't do this, or I don't have experience of this and it's going to be really obvious to others. And I might find things overwhelming. And I think over the years, I've got really good at being able to work with a growth mindset, for example, to counter those negative self-talk items or the frames that sometimes come out of my mouth out loud, not just in my own mind, but sometimes I'll say it out loud. But I really thought we hear quite often the phrase imposter syndrome. And what's intriguing is your take on and the way that you're describing it in terms of imposter phenomenon. And that was a fairly new concept to me until fairly recently. And of course, you've shared some lovely content on that. And I find that the imposter syndrome thing isn't necessarily something in those moments where I have those fleeting thoughts of I'm not good enough or whatever that might show up like. I can't sort of take two paracetamol with a glass of water before bed and that resolves all ills. That would be wonderful if that were the case. So I just wondered your thoughts on what is imposter syndrome, if it is a thing, imposter phenomenon, how that all fits together. Talk me through what your thoughts are.
Okay, so imposter syndrome is kind of the common term, but that implies a clinical diagnosis, which there is not one for imposterism. So if we're going to be really technically correct, it's imposter phenomenon. And because I did my master's in this and got into the whole geeking out in academia and being very correct with things, that's probably permeated my language. But whether it's imposter syndrome, imposter phenomenon, or anything else, it's trying to articulate something about what you're experiencing and a want, I guess, maybe to change something about that. For me, the language day to day when I'm working with people is probably more imposter thoughts, because as you said, Laura, typically we don't have them all the time. Kind of, we look at experience, it's on a bell curve. Some people have zero thoughts about being unsure of themselves. Some people are right in the weeds with that, and that's their permanent experience. And for me, definitely they're experiencing imposter phenomenon or imposter syndrome, however they want to label it. But most of us are in the middle with imposter type thoughts.
I like the way you described it there as imposterism. That's definitely the thing that probably shows up for me, or those imposter thoughts. And I wonder, is there any correlation with how we manage those thoughts, if that's the right phrase, or how we deal with them? Is there something that does link to growth mindset? You know, what do we do in those moments? Because I hear a lot of people, if I think about even conversations I have with friends or family, not just colleagues or clients, there's sometimes that little imposter moment that sort of shows up where people go, oh, that's not me. That's not me. I couldn't do that. So how do we help people in those moments sort of manage that, if that's the right phrase?
So I don't think there's one clear-cut way. And actually, when I started the research for my master's, I took the opportunity because what we have is kind of mainstream solutions. So things like focus on the facts of your performance, talk about your feelings. I think a lot of people are doing that. I do think that's healthy, but I don't know that it moves you forward sometimes. It kind of almost allows you to wallow in it. Just celebrate success, let go of perfectionism. If you're a perfectionist, that's not an easy thing to do. So I was like, oh, there's all of these strategies, yet I still feel like an imposter and I can't implement any of them. So that's kind of where my research has gone. And I'd love to say that there's one solution to resolving everything. But I don't think that exists. But there are a few things that kind of from my research start to feel more true for me. But I think if we go back a little bit, one of the challenges that's coming out in the research now is that we're starting to see lots of meta-analysis or systemic reviews of existing research around imposter phenomenon. And there is a huge amount of research. And it's highlighting that there's some challenges in the research which might link to the fact that suggested scenarios or solutions don't work. And that's that we've kind of got lots of overlap with different experiences or different kind of constructs psychologically. So there's correlations between imposter phenomenon and self-esteem or perfectionism. So we're not really drilling down correctly into what is a imposter phenomenon and where are the boundaries of that. So who really is experiencing imposter phenomenon or feelings specifically, and what would work for them? What actually is something about confidence or self-esteem or perfectionism? Because those solutions look a little bit different. So there's a lot of kind of murkiness in there, but I'm really delighted that these articles are calling it out as we start to understand more about humans and how we operate. There is a lot more research to be done. So I think that's kind of in the background that confuses things. And there's even one article I read the other day that thinks that imposter phenomenon is actually a symptom rather than a being, a construct itself. So that would be interesting as well. Where does that all fall out? So there's a lot of research that still needs to be done, and a lot of longitudinal studies and looking at more diverse groups. And that will take time, sadly. So I think what I'm finding now is just things that feel from the different bits of research and also my own experience, because definitely somebody who has those imposter feelings on a regular basis, there are a few things that I think are really, really helpful. So some things are reframing, but it's not reframing and just focusing on our success. Sometimes it's thinking about who are the people that we want to pay attention to? Because quite often when we're feeling this imposterism, it's because we think people are going to view us in a particular way. So who do we want to think about when we're considering whether we're worthy of a particular opportunity or congratulations and a recognition for things? And I really love the stuff that Brené Brown does around kind of who's in the cheap seats. And sometimes we really do pay attention, or we worry about the perspective of people who have never, ever been in the arena. They're never out there. I think she talks about people, if you've not been out there getting your ass kicked, then I don't want to hear from you.
Yeah.
That is so true. And Adam Grant talks about kind of coaching critics. Who are the people who will give you really great feedback, tell you how it is, but also give you the kind of feedback that you can act on? Because I think if you've got feedback that you can act on, then you focus on progressing. If you've got feedback that's kind of airy-fairy and not really got any structure or content to it, you just sit with it and then you start to do that negative self-talk and worry about, oh, well, somebody said that about me once. If we can learn to say, actually, that's not useful feedback, but that is, and I'm going to work on that, maybe it just distracts our brains and focuses on something really helpful and productive rather than something that becomes a perpetual cycle of rumination. How does that sound? Just those first bits.
Oh my gosh, brilliant. I love that. And I love the references to the work of Brené Brown and Adam Grant. I think those are great people just doing some great work, aren't they? And I think Brené Brown's got a podcast. I need to listen to that. I must do, because I don't think I've tapped into that yet. So for sure. And the reframing thing comes up often for me in a coaching conversation with clients. And I'll certainly have conversations with people when I hear that negative self-talk sort of transcend into the conversation actively, to sort of let's find evidence of where that isn't true, because sometimes we sort of magnify that. And something you said there about, you know, who is it that's in that space? I find often my negative self-talk or that imposter thought comes up when I start to compare myself to others. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Definitely. I think there is definitely comparatonitis out there. And so we do need to find our people who we know will give us the feedback that really matters. And they should be the people that we're paying attention to. And also it's where we start to find a support network or coaches and mentors. Because again, I think talking about it in a way that helps us move forward is really important as well. Because it is, again, very, very easy to wallow. And then in a couple of the articles that I put on LinkedIn that people were chatting about, some of the interesting things that came out of there was also being unsure and feeling not quite ready has almost through social media become a real issue. Like, we've got to be perfect from the get-go. But actually, our greatest learning is when we try things that we're not quite ready for. So we need to almost renormalize this whole thing. If you're going to try things in your life and you're not going to be ready for them, but that's where you learn, waiting to be ready, that's never, never, ever going to happen. So if you feel unsure or you feel uncertain or you're not quite sure that you're ready, maybe have those conversations with the right people. But also, that's probably the stuff you need to step towards. And we need to get okay with a little bit of discomfort and celebrate the fact that people are really great at dealing with, you know, kind of feeling the discomfort and doing it anyway. So that conversation needs to be more in there. Even just this morning, I was chatting to a couple of people about professionals who have new people, graduates coming into their workplace, and they're not asking questions and they're not showing that uncertainty, which in those fields is quite high risk. And just what's going on there that means that they would rather jump in and on occasion maybe cause harm to somebody else because they don't want to ask for feedback or they don't want to ask for help, or perhaps they've not had enough feedback, which tells them they believe that kind of Dunning-Kruger thing, low competence, high self-belief versus high competence, worrying about whether you're quite where you should be. And everyone's saying, I'd much rather have somebody who holds their hands up and says, I'm not sure, can I check in with you, than work with somebody who blindly runs on as well. So again, there's something about normalizing that. And I'd rather feel a bit of that imposterism than just go ahead blindly. When I look at the world stage right now, there's a lot of stuff and people acting in a way that makes me think, I wish you doubted yourself just a smidge. Because if you did, perhaps things would be a bit smoother and a bit more thoughtful in the way that you approach that. So for me, I also don't want to be that person who is so sure of themselves that I make grave errors and perhaps don't even care or notice that those errors are occurring.
Yeah.
So there's benefits to it as well. I think it makes it better, us better people. Adam Grant says he'd rather hire people with imposter phenomenon than not, because people who have imposter phenomenon, who doubt themselves just a little bit, they're eager to learn. They know that there's an opportunity to grow, so that curiosity is there. Their ego doesn't get in the way when there's a need to collaborate or to have your opinions challenged in some way. So there's lots of really great stuff that can come from these feelings too. So might be unhelpful at times, but that doesn't make them negative.
Yeah, I think what you expressed there, Charlotte, really well is that learning space, isn't it? That it is okay not to know some things, and that uncertainty. And again, I'm just reflecting as you're chatting us all through that, there are times where I've thought, oh, do you know, I'm not sure about this. And then does that hold us back because we're not going to take that opportunity because we're uncertain or we don't feel skilled or resourced enough in this particular area? But actually, could we take that punt, take that small calculated risk, try things out? You know, none of us have got to the lovely ages that we are all here today without having gone through significant learning experiences of things that we've never done before. And that's the process of learning, isn't it? That you try it out. Yes, it might be, I call these our squeaky bum moments. You know, we might be in that space where we're thinking, oh, is this going to work out? But we'll never know unless we try. And coming back to your feedback point, there's feedback in that, isn't there? What worked? What didn't work? What would you do differently next time? What was the learning opportunity in that? You know, I've tried it. And sometimes we maybe don't try things or do things, maybe because of that, what will other people think if I do this? But I'm also of that opinion, what will other people think if I don't? You know, I actually want to try out some things. And if it doesn't work, hold my hand up and say, this didn't work. But actually, here's what's coming next. That move forward point's really vital, isn't it?
And in organisations, it's that psychological safety.
Absolutely.
You know, of recognising that we're not going to be perfect at everything. And that's absolutely okay, as long as there's learning. And I think the more that we move people towards that mindset of, I'm absolutely going to fail at some stuff, but my belief in myself, because people talk about confidence a lot with all of this stuff. For me, confidence is trusting in yourself. And that's not trusting that you have the answers, but that you have the resourcefulness to navigate whatever lies ahead, to do the best that you can. And I think if we normalize people being confident in that ability to try new things and to navigate it and know that they've got a good support network or they're great critical thinkers. People get into that whole thing of sometimes we'll fail, but absolutely there's no consequence for that. As long as I've learned and as long as I stopped it at an appropriate time. All of that stuff from an organisational perspective, I think, is really, really useful. So all of the psychological safety stuff, regardless of kind of which person you're following for the theory on that, I think really makes a difference for people as well.
Yeah, and I like what you said there as well, in particular around the normalising, asking questions. Because again, if you think about that psychological safety aspect, some people are a little bit hesitant or reticent to put their hand up and say, I don't know something, or I've made a mistake, or I'm stuck even. Those are quite vulnerable statements that we might say out loud to another person, that we might think, if I say this, what will people think of me? They'll think I'm not good enough, or, you know, Laura again making a mistake, my goodness, this is terrible. But actually, if we meet people on that point of support and curiosity and the congratulations of the success for trying things out, because otherwise people hide the mistakes, don't they? And then it becomes even more massive rather than just saying, I've made a mistake and here's what I've learned from it. What can I take from that going forward? So definitely need to normalize that asking of questions, because that perfectionism, I did chuckle when you said that earlier in my mind, because sometimes I'll be like, oh, I can't talk about this until it's fully updated on the website, or, you know, and even I mentioned to you at the start, I'm working on the website next week, for example, and there's a little bit of me that's held back on sharing some stuff because I feel it has to be perfect. But actually, does it have, what is perfect? I don't even know what that is if I think about it out loud. So, you know, is there an imposter in there, perhaps something around that? Who knows?
Yeah, and maybe that is just perfectionism. You are always super polished. I will say this every time I see
you. Oh, thank you. I'm genuinely not, but I'm clearly giving something off that is, so I'll take that feedback. So thank you.
Definitely feel slight imposterism when I'm alongside you for that.
Oh, you behave.
Definitely polished. Yes, yeah, so there is a lot that we can normalise, and I think once that happens, we start to move in a really good direction. One of the things, because I went to see Adam Grant and Brené Brown in Amsterdam. Yes. And I managed to resist the temptation to jump on the stage and like kiss both of them, which is probably for the best. Otherwise, I might not have made it back home.
You'd be in jail.
I know. It'd be exciting, wouldn't it? Adam Grant talked about a book called Beautiful Oops, which is for kids. And it's starting off that journey of realizing that mistakes turn into beautiful things. So like a coffee mug stain on a piece of paper can then become part of an amazing piece of artwork. And I think we could start really early with kids about just not squashing the creativity and noticing that in every mistake, there is something quite beautiful that comes out of it. I think even like a lot of my work, some of that stuff is just been massive mistakes. And I'm like, oh, I quite like that. That's something to be interested in and move me in a particular direction. And we need to celebrate that as well. What do mistakes give us that success doesn't?
Yeah. Oh, I love this. I like that recommendation, Beautiful Oops. I can think of loads of oops moments. I'm loving this. Yeah, definitely.
And then some other stuff that I've been talking about with people is kind of just the nature of thought as well, because we put a lot of weight in our thoughts as being true, and they feel true, but that does not make them factually correct. So spend a lot of time in workshops just chatting about the nature of thought, and quite often using like bubbles or kaleidoscopes just to show kind of how little things change the way that our thoughts work. So sometimes they're so fleeting and there can be so many of them. Little nudges and knocks suddenly change our perspective massively. The fact that even when we recall memories, it's not an accurate recollection. Our brain reconstructs a memory every single time we tap into it. So it's never absolutely a reflection of what we experienced. So again, knowing that, can we hold our thoughts a little more lightly and maybe chuckle at our brains and just say, see what you're doing? Because imposterism does have a purpose. It is there. Some of the research is kind of what is reflection. So some of my research looked at reflection versus rumination. So they're part of self-focused attention, which people think is kind of a precursor to imposter feelings. And reflection is forward focus. It's about learning and growth. It's not got that emotional attachment. Rumination it's got a lot of emotional attachment, tends to be looking at exactly what we're doing now or in the past. And it doesn't have an escape mechanism. It's kind of just that repeated thoughts. There is something in there. Our brain is desperately trying to save us from ourselves in that moment. And it's that thing that you mentioned, Laura, about what do other people think about us. Social connection is such a huge part of our DNA and where we fit in the group, because there's lots of advantages from us from an evolutionary perspective of being within the group and being liked, loved, cared for. You know, if you're part of that group, you're safer in so many respects if you're living on the plains of Africa. Hundreds of thousands of years ago, and we've still got that there. So our brain is worried that perhaps we're going to do something that causes risk, or perhaps it recognizes that we're heading towards burnout. So we need to start thinking about those things, just noticing, what's my brain doing there? Is it trying to keep me safe? I get that it's doing that, but actually I don't need to be kept safe in this scenario. So just having a little chuckle at it. Or actually, am I overextended right now? I'm not in a good place or space to do that. Is that why the rumination's kicking in? That's really great data to kind of play with, to either hold it lightly and laugh at it, or perhaps take some action because we haven't noticed that we're running on fumes.
Yeah. I again, I'm thinking about my own thoughts recently, and that rumination thing really stagnates progress because I'll get stuck in that and I know what my pattern is. So my pattern, exactly as you've described, I'll then get to a point of I'll ruminate on things so significantly, go down almost a rabbit hole with it. And then I get to a point of overwhelm, and that overwhelm leads to frustration, and that frustration leads to more procrastination, and that procrastination leads me to a point of exhaustion when I need a little nap. And actually, that is sometimes an unhelpful strategy, of course, but sometimes it's the pause that's needed just to bring myself back, if that makes sense. So I like that, you know, that little chuckle at it. What is this giving me as data right now? What do I need to do with that information?
Yeah, and there's a lot of evolutionary drivers that were so useful once upon a time and are occasionally useful right now in today's world. We do, our brain needs to notice where there's a potential risk. It's just that it puts the same weight in that social risk as kind of a physical risk. Yeah, we just need to see our thoughts for what they are and kind of learn not to play with them, because the more we play with them, the bigger and gnarlier they get. And we have around about 60,000 thoughts a day. So if we can let go of that one and let it pass, then, you know, there's plenty of others that are going to come behind it. And some of them are going to be awesome and some of them are just going to be a bit crappy. But again, it's just knowing that is the nature of thought and a human existence, and that there's nothing wrong with that. That is just how it is. So our brains doing what they're designed to do is something that we just need to acknowledge too in some of this stuff.
Yeah, loving it. You spoke about something very recently on your LinkedIn channel, and I really am intrigued by this. You talked about a jingle jangle fallacy, is that it? If I got that right phrase?
Yes.
And I'm intrigued about that as well, because it says jingle jangle and I'm like, oh, that sounds fun.
I won't lie, I'm not the greatest readers. I've got some issues with kind of my visual processing skills. But when I see a word that I really love, it does pull me into that. So guidance for all academics, something exciting language-wise will help people like me read more. But this is part of this kind of wider review of research around this topic, and just recognizing this jingle-jangle fallacy, which is either we're labelling a few different things as one thing, or actually we've just got that murkiness of conflagrating what is what. So jingle jangle, but it is just where the boundaries and the labelling of psychological phenomena has got a little bit mixed up one way or another. And that's really interesting. Yeah. Again, it's just why we're not finding the solutions, because there is just a little bit of confusion about the boundaries of imposter phenomenon with other psychological phenomena. And perhaps we're lumping some stuff into imposter phenomenon that's something else, or we're calling it imposter phenomenon and it is actually something else. So it's a difficult one, but it definitely for me is exciting that researchers are talking about this, because that prompts other types of research to grow from that and for people to really revisit everything. But it will take a little bit of time, I guess, to unpick the human experience, which is vast and complex, and we're all a bit weird and also fabulous at the same time, which makes it quirky and difficult to do.
Indeed, I love that. And it leads me, I'm really pleased there's a lot being done on this recently and that there will be a continuation of that, because I've definitely heard pockets of feedback from people previously where they've sort of dismissed imposter syndrome as that label, as not being a thing. Or I've also heard people, and I don't know if this is based on research or hearsay, but actually imposter syndrome as that label, and I like the fact that it's imposter phenomenon or that imposter thought or feeling or imposterism. I like those titles rather than imposter syndrome, because it's not something you take a tablet for, in my mind. And I've heard a lot of people say it's something that predominantly shows up in women as opposed to other genders, or it's just not a thing? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on both those points, if you have any.
So I think women talk about it a lot more, definitely. And the research that's out there at the moment would say that there's a higher incidence within women and marginalised groups, because there's a lot of society stuff that sits around why we feel the way that we do. You know, what's our role in society? What does good look like? So we've got like centuries of stuff to unpick, really, around lots of marginalised groups. So definitely shows up more there. There's also quite a lot of research there, and perhaps research focuses on a pocket of people rather than a more diverse group. And also the longitudinal studies don't exist. So there's gaps there. And then you've got some studies that'll say 8% of people experience this, right the way up to, or is it 8 or 9, right the way up to 80% of people experience it. So you've got, depending on the study, depends on how big it is. But more women, but definitely men feel it too, but perhaps it manifests a little bit differently. So as women, from a societal perspective, we probably endure quite a lot around expectations and trying to kind of be parents or carers alongside full-time jobs and what types of jobs should we be and how should we live, how should we dress, and who should we marry. There's a lot of things historically that we've kind of navigated. And that seems to enable us to kind of manage the imposter feelings a little more effectively. We're almost counterphobic. So despite getting this, kind of having these feelings, we plow on. There's a resilience that comes with our experience of life. Men also have all of these messages around kind of masculinity and what you can share and what you can't share. So I think one of the things we have to be mindful of is that historically men have been told that they can't share these feelings and they're not allowed to talk about how they feel. So we probably don't have as many examples of that or people feeling comfortable talking about it, but in the research, men do feel it. But perhaps because of some of those pressures, we start to see slightly different behaviours coming out. So rather than that ploughing on, but talking about it quite openly, some of the research indicates that men might be inclined to kind of not want to talk about it. And the minute that they show any weakness in inverted commas for having these imposter feelings, they almost double down and take high risk within the workplace to show that they are fine and that they are strong and that they can do everything. Some people might actually talk about it. Some men might talk about it when they're at that point of breaking. So they've hit that burnout point and actually it's starting to come out because they recognize that they're not well, because they've just been digging deep and pushing on and ignoring kind of where their well-being is at. So almost there's this correlation a little bit with burnout too. I think we're also moving in the right direction where we're talking about this more with people. So more people are exploring it, playing with it, working out what it is for them. And I think we're seeing a lot more men doing that as well. And I really love that. So again, it'll be interesting as we get more research and more people are talking about this and feeling comfortable talking about it. And perhaps we get more clarity around constructs and what it truly means and what it really is. You know, what are the defining aspects of it? More people will be able to talk about it in a way that's really useful. And maybe the term imposterism will disappear altogether. Who knows? It's a heavy label. I read a beautiful article and they talked about the fact that there's like a criminality attached to being an imposter. That kind of is a label. It's quite weighty for people to hold as well. And perhaps there's better language that we could be using as that clarity emerges. But we'll have to wait and see where the research goes.
Yeah. I really love that. I can't wait to see where the research goes on this. I think it is. I like how you described that. It's a weighty title, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Automatically thinking about, you know, old school Batman TV program where you had the characters show up, like the Joker, for example. You know, there's that element of that imposter that shows up. It is weighty, so I can see where that construct comes from.
Yeah.
It's such a great subject. I could talk to you about this for a very, very long time.
We can do it again.
Yes,
because there's so much I don't know. So I'll put that in mind. Yeah, my imposter feelings is that I'm not sure what the answers are here. So I've got thoughts. I don't know how many of them will manifest into something really real and true for people. But it is doing a dance with a topic that I find fascinating, and just wanting to help more. So everything that I share, I put this on one of my posts, it helps me sense make.
Yeah.
That it helps other people too. So there's more of this conversation to be had, and I'm definitely not 100% correct or knowledgeable on any of it. It's just a journey, not destination.
It's a great conversation to continue having though, isn't it? And I can't wait to hear more of what your exploration allows us to hear and consider. Any final thoughts or anything else that you think actually I didn't get the chance to share this particular piece that you feel would be good for our listeners? Any final top tips or recommendations?
I think we are flawsome, so we're flawed and we're awesome, and we need to really embrace that. One of the tools that I did look at in my research was around career adaptability skills. And I think that's really key for helping us focus where we want to go. So one of the tools that I looked at, it explores our strengths in these areas about kind of our interest and preparation for the future. And what's really interesting with this is when I looked at it, I was like, yes, I'm very prepared for the future. But then as I read the questions, I was like, I do think about this a lot, but I'm not sure that my thoughts ever move me in any particular direction. And so it's great work with a coach to go through this. So it's, how prepared are you for the future? You know, do you know what your future looks like? Are you, it's that intentionality that you were talking about, Laura. How intentional are you in the decisions that you make day to day? And I know that I am like, I flit like, I'm like a magpie. I'm like, oh, shininess. So how intentional are you there? Control, so kind of what are you taking responsibility in the choices that you make for the future? How many different alternative futures do you explore? So that curiosity is part of that, which I think is really important as well, because sometimes we attach a lot of our identity and expectation to one particular thing. But what if we were looking at those squiggly careers and kind of actively planning for different futures and doing a bit of horizon scanning about what could be there? Especially as we know jobs are changing so quickly now, and that, you know, I don't know what the stat is now for in 5 years, 50% of the jobs won't even have been thought about today, that will be around in 5 years or something like that. And then that confidence or belief in ourselves, are we building the skills that allow us to know that we've got the excellence within ourselves? So I think there's something around that. Sorry. And then the other thing is that reflection and rumination. Some of the research that I looked at implies that, or suggests that, we ruminate because our reflection skills haven't given us a result. So if our reflection skills were effective, we wouldn't go into that self-protection mode. So I'm really curious in my exploration, if anybody's got ideas on this, I'd love to hear it. How do we make reflection more effective, more frequent? And there's lots of stuff that plows into that. So things like the curse of expertise I came across a few weeks ago, where when we're innately good at something, when we've really built that superpower and that skill, we're actually not that great at supporting others to come on the journey because we've forgotten what it's like to be a novice. The other side of that is that we really don't see how great we are, and we've lost complete awareness of where our skills and our potential and our aptitude sits. So reflection has a really great part in just reminding us that we've got these skills. So when we do tackle the unknown and we feel unsure or not quite ready, we can kind of say, I'm not quite ready, but you know what? I've got this. It'll be fine. I can pull myself out of this situation in any way, shape or form if I need to. So there's something for me around that active planning and using something like a career adaptability to really, really deeply think around where we're going and what the future could look like in many guises. And coaches and mentors, I think, are really great there to work with us and kind of hold us accountable. And then also that really powerful reflection on a regular basis in a way that's practical and meaningful, because I think a lot of us are guilty of not doing self-reflection that's really helpful. So again, we ponder and then we don't do it well enough, so then we move into the rumination.
Yeah, great. Charlotte, this is such fascinating topics. Interestingly, in one of our recent episodes, we talked about the power of intention and the power of reflection, and I completely agree with you, we don't spend enough genuinely useful time in that space. I love this thought of the career adaptability skill and the tool. And of course, I recommend everyone to follow you on LinkedIn because you share lots about this, but also a lot of other great topics. Charlotte, what's the best way to get in touch with you? So how do we find you on LinkedIn? How would we find you if we wanted to open up further conversations? What's the best routes?
I think LinkedIn has kind of become my place to go. I don't know if that makes me really old because I speak to a lot of graduates and they're just like, is LinkedIn really a thing?
Yes.
It's the thing where I exist. What are you talking about? But yes, I'm on LinkedIn, Charlotte Angus. Send me a message, connect with me. Tell me why you're connecting as well. I always love it when people put a connection. I try and do this. I know we've got limited messages, so if you don't, I won't be offended. But get in touch, follow, add to the conversation as well, because some of the stuff that I've shared today has just come from those LinkedIn conversations, because I'm like, oh, that's fascinating. Like, why do we think this way? Or that's a different perspective to look at it. So please be part of the conversation, because I think that debate and that challenge is really, really useful.
Absolutely. And would it be okay, Charlotte, if we share some of the article references that you've used on the podcast show notes? And of course, we'll put all of your lovely connection links on there for everyone to make sure they can get in touch.
Absolutely.
Fab. I love that. And let's pick up this conversation maybe later in the year, see what else the learnings are and any additional thoughts around this area and anything else, because you've got such great gifts to share with the world. And that's why one of the many reasons I love you lots. Yeah. And I'm super pleased you've been able to join us today, Charlotte. Thank you so, so much. It's been a real joy to share this time with you. And I hope everyone listening, take Charlotte up on that offer, get in touch, follow you for that active conversation. And of course, you do lots of things in organisations. Maybe there's some people out there who would really benefit from you, your skill set, your just general fabulous self, and all the lovely pieces of work that you're doing out in the big bad world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me as well. I've really loved it.
You're so welcome anytime. So everyone that is listening, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. So dnacoach.co.uk/podcast. And don't forget to join next time. We've got some more lovely guest interviewees. I nearly got that wrong. Coming up, which is fab. And of course, some individual episodes with me. So thank you for joining today. I've been Laura Royal with the lovely Charlotte Angus on the Coaches and Leaders Assemble podcast.